right, and joining us now is Eric Peters of epautos.com. And we're going to talk about what has happened to automotive journalism, as well as the state of freedom and how it's being attacked in so many different ways, on the road, off the road. But thank you for joining us, Eric. Always great to talk to you.
Oh, thanks for having me on, David. I'm busily packing my bags to get ready to move into one of Trump's freedom cities.
I can't believe people fall for that. I don't mean, it was actually AJ put that out, Alex Jones put that out to say that, yeah, look, he's fighting the New World Order. It's like he's implementing the New World Order. You've always talked about Agenda 21. That's what it is to a T. I mean, it's just amazing to me. But
yeah, sometimes I just want to take one of my shoes off and hit myself in the head with it until I'm insensible.
That's right. It's crazy. It is. It truly is a satire world that we live in. Speaking of satire worlds, let's begin with this Progressive insurance commercial. I'm sure you're familiar with Flo, their spokesperson. And of course, this is a new commercial. I'm not going to play it. A new commercial where the camera crew goes to a guy's house and surprises him and gives him something because he's a safe driver, but also especially because he's not driving too much. They're all about that, aren't they?
Mm-hmm. They sure are. Yep.
They have been pushing. We got and again, you know, they have actually. The person who sent that to me says, yeah, my daughter does that, and still she can't understand why their insurance is so high because she's driving pretty fast and reckless. But they you know, have pushed that, especially for younger kids, especially in the UK, where they make it so expensive for the kids to even buy car insurance.
Yeah,
I've read stories about siblings who go in halves on their car insurance and on the car itself. And they have to ration how much they drive because it doesn't just measure how they drive, but how much they drive. It's a new a new tactic that's coming out there with another form, really, of toll, if you stop and think about it.
Yeah, well, we're not that far behind here. You know, insurance is already exorbitant for teen drivers. And I get, to a certain extent, why their rates are higher. They're new. They're inexperienced. Statistically, they tend to be more likely to be involved in an accident. But it does not correlate with the amounts that they're charging people on the order of $2,000-$3,000 a year, which is just preposterous.
Yeah, we used to always see that when we were kids. We had higher rates, as you know, when you were young and you were learning how to drive a car, and it was justified. In my case, I nearly killed myself several times.
Yeah, sure.
But I didn't have an accident. But I mean, you know, some pretty crazy stuff. And I was in a car with other teenagers, and they were driving, or I was driving.
Well, it's a 1-2 punch. On the one hand, you've got the insurance costs, and then on the other hand, you've got the cost of the cars themselves. And largely due to the Obama-era Cash for Clunker program, there are virtually no affordable, drivable, decent, used cars available anymore for first-time drivers.
That's
you
right.
Can't go out and find a decent vehicle for $2,000. Maybe you can, but it's extremely difficult. So, you know,
actually,
the entry-level price point, to get something that's viable for a 16-year-old kid, you know, you're looking at probably $4,000 or $5,000 or so, and that's quite a hump for most kids that age to get, unless their parents help them along.
I agree.
And a lot of people aren't in that position.
I agree. Yeah, we needed to get a truck, and then my son needed a car, and they found an auction site, and they were able to get great deals on these things. They got them like less than half of what the book value was at the auction thing. Of course, you know, you got to take a certain amount of risk, but you always do when you get a used car, and they give you a chance to drive the thing for a couple of hours and check it out, and you can bring it back within a couple of hours if you find some kind of a major flaw with it. We got this truck, Eric, that is, they were telling me about. I told them, I said, I don't care. We got to get a truck. I don't really care what the thing looks like. Just get it cheap, you know? So they said, well, we got it, but it's got this headliner that's that's like got a cloth, and it's got all kinds of lights in it and all the rest of the stuff. And it's got a rhinestone steering wheel and a big thing of the whole back seat was taken out so they could put speakers in it. But it's a truck, you know, so whatever.
Sure.
Everybody, they only had to bid against people who were online. They said anybody who was there at the auction site that actually saw the truck would not buy it. The thing is jacked up. That's the other thing too. And the guy said to my wife, he said, I want to see you get in that truck.
That's part of the fun of it. That's part of what gives those first cars character. I had years and years ago, I bought a 64 Corvair. It was drivable, but it needed a bunch of work. And in the process of going through it, I pulled the back seat out, and somebody had built a mini bar in the back of it back in the hippie days. It still had the decanters in it and everything.
That's funny. That's funny. Well, talking about going back to the good old days, you got an article, The Decline and Fall of Automotive Journalism.
Yeah.
And how it died. And as a matter of fact, you say died when they were bought up by the drug cartels. Kudos to Woody Harrelson. Yeah, exactly. He nailed it, didn't he?
He did. You know, he did a great mitzvah or service. And even more so in that so far, he has withstood the immense pressure that's been brought to bear on him for daring to utter the unutterable on Saturday Night Live about the drug cartels and the vaccines. And he actually has been a man about it and stood up and just hasn't done the mea culpa tour. So he's gone up in my estimation by 500%.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. It had to be said. I'm glad he said it, and I'm glad he's not backing down. But, you know, I think about the old automotive journalism. I think of David E. Davis. I loved his stuff. I think it was Car and Driver that he wrote for. He had that column, Cogito Ergo Zoom. I think, therefore, I speed. I don't know.
Yeah, back in those days, car journalists generally were people who liked cars, at the least, and understood them. And more importantly, too, they were also legit journalists in that they looked into things and reported the truth about them, very much contrary to the practice today. I was appalled by this article I saw that was published by Jalopnik, which is a pretty big site. And, you know, the headline read something like, EVs are now cheaper than the average non-electric car. And I thought, what pipe are these people smoking? So I dug into it a little bit. And they very, very oilily misled people reading the article by conflating the transaction price. That's the industry term for what people sometimes pay for a car with what the average price of a car is.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, leading people to believe that spending $45,000 on an EV is actually a bargain relative to the almost $50,000 that the average car transacted for last year. And it was a real, you know, just sleazy shuck and jive. And they didn't put that in any context. And they also left out a critical point, which is that when you buy a base EV, you buy the base battery. You know, so you buy the base battery and the thing doesn't go very far. For example, the low-cost Tesla Model 3 that's about $44,000 has, I think it is a 270-something mile range, something like that. If you want the one that goes more than 300 miles, it's something like $55,000.
Wow.
And you know, they don't mention that. I mean, how many times would you ever go out and buy, when you buy a non-electric car, you don't have to pay extra to get a bigger gas tank, you know, usually, unless it's a heavy-duty truck.
Yeah.
And it's just the fact that they don't say these things or write these things or explain these things to people makes my teeth fall out of my head every time I have to deal with it.
I haven't read Jalopnik in a very, very long time, just because they're so biased. I mean, they've got an agenda. It's very clear. It's as clear as if you're talking to ChatGPT. They've got an agenda that they want to push on you. And again, for the most part, most of them are not car people. And that's really one of the things that you were talking about. The first time you saw, I played just before you came on, because I know that our guests can't hear the videos or see them. I played a back and forth between a diversity hire pick for the Biden administration for the FAA, doesn't know anything about planes, doesn't know anything about the agency, doesn't know anything about the rules of the agency for planes, zero, zip. I mean, one question after the other in his confirmation hearing, didn't know anything. But that's what you've seen happen to automotive journalism, and you start talking about this going back to the 90s with a lady at USA Today, tell people a story.
Sure. Well, they hired this woman mainly because she had a nice rack, and she knew nothing about cars, and she couldn't write very well.
Is that a gun rack?
The kind of rack that women tend to have. And then there was the other example of Warren Brown over at the Washington Post, who I knew personally, and Warren Brown was a nice guy and a good business writer, but they tapped him to be their car reviewer. And Warren didn't even know how to drive a car with a manual transmission at the time that he was tapped to be their car reviewer. They dropped off a Porsche 911 for him to drive, and he couldn't drive it. The Porsche people had to show him how to drive it because he didn't know how to drive a stick. You know, and it kind of begs the question, why would you put people in that position? Well, the answer is, of course, because Warren happened to be a black guy. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the woman over at USA Today happened to be female. And so there was this push, even then, back in the 90s, to bean count and to assign jobs based on what color your skin is and, you know, what kind of genitalia you were born with, rather than whether you knew something or had any business writing about the topic at hand.
I like what you had to say. She had as much business writing about cars as Liberace had writing about dating. Well, women.
Yes, exactly.
That's a great line.
And then the best story that I've got, this one left me gaping for breath for a little while. I had to recover. I was at the New York Auto Show. This was, I don't know, probably around 1994-ish, something like that, during the press preview days. And I was just sitting on the bus with other journalists waiting for the next presentation. And this guy approached me and started talking to me, and he identified himself as somebody who was a writer for the Wall Street Journal. And he said he knew that I wrote about motorcycles. And he asked me my advice about how to get into bikes. And so I just assumed that he was somebody like me who had motorcycles and was into motorcycles. And so I asked him what bikes he had. And he admitted to me that he'd never owned a bike and he didn't know how to ride a bike, but he wanted to write about motorcycles for the Wall Street Journal.
There you go. Yeah, that's perfect. My son, Travis, says the average valet parker would be better at reviewing cars than most car journalists. I think that's absolutely right. Especially the guy who was the valet parker for Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Yeah, you know, and at least those guys actually liked cars. I think that's my biggest gripe. You know, the people who are doing the car journalism today, a lot of them are people who very obviously to me just don't care. They're not interested in cars. They might as well be writing about cell phones. They view them as appliances, and you know that's what's killing everything. It used to be about the passion and the emotion and the fun of it, and that's all being just sucked right out of the whole profession.
That's right. Yeah, they write about them as if they are appliances, or now as if they are, you know, boom boxes or iPhones or something like that. Even to the extent that you see a new Mercedes come out, it's like, oh, look at all the it's got a supercomputer in it. It's like, oh, really? How much energy does that use? I mean, they want to try to push out their digital currencies and criticize and ban cryptocurrency because it's just not green enough. Well, really? Well, then, you know, what does it do for energy consumption? Because, you know, you got to charge it back up whenever you use it. You've got all this computer tech inside the Mercedes going to reduce its range and all the rest of the stuff because, you know, the fast computers are going to use a lot of power. That's what their complaint is about crypto.
Have been homogenized. They're all the same. You know, you get into a Mercedes S-Class, and it's got a flat screen display. You get into a Ford Mach-E, which is $40,000 versus $100,000. It has a flat screen display. You get into a $30,000 Hyundai. It has essentially the same flat screen display. That's what it all is now. It's an extruded plastic blob with a flat screen display.
Yeah, you say it's about crossoverism, and you say, well, you know, these guys want to talk about you know, the cargo capacity, how big is the trunk, or, you know, how much, what's the gas mileage or the range or thing. And that's really all that's there at this point. And so even though they don't know anything about cars or really care anything about cars, it is, as you said, an appliance. They're just reporting on the capacities of it.
Yeah, it's very, very depressing. And seeing the trend not only continue to go in that direction, but accelerate. I published an article this morning about Subaru having jumped onto the ESG bandwagon after they took care of Toyota a couple of weeks ago. They're doing the parking brake 180 and embracing electrification and going to take all the joy and interest and, to use their favorite word of the left, diversity out of Subaru, too.
Yeah, yeah. And, of course, they can't do the parking brake 180 because it's electric parking brake.
There is one, you're right.
You don't have a lever to pull the thing up and do a Rockford spin or something like that. I got a question from some listeners here. They said, can you ask Eric if he ever listens to Scotty Kilmer? I always found Scotty to be very entertaining. And he's, for people who don't know him, he's got a big YouTube channel. Yep. He's a mechanic working out of Houston. And I don't know. What do you think of Scotty?
Oh, I think he's hilarious. Uh-huh. I think he's not only hilarious, but I think he's a mensch, meaning just he's a regular guy. I don't think he's trying to sell anybody a bill of goods like, you know, like me or like anybody else. He's not omniscient. He doesn't know everything, and he's not always right. But I think he tries to get it right. I think he does a good job of presenting his information in an engaging and humorous way. And I think that's the apotheosis of what we do in this profession, or at least what we should aspire to doing.
That's right. And he gives people his honest opinion. You know, if he thinks the car is really good or if he thinks it's bad, he'll tell you what its strong points are and its weak points are. He's not worried about offending the car company. And he'll even tell you, you know, I saw one of his videos where he talked about Toyotas versus a Lexus. And he goes, get yourself a Toyota, put in an extra sound deadening insulation equipment, and you got a Lexus. You know, save yourself some money.
That's right, and you don't even have to do that. You know, a lot of people don't understand or know that the Lexus brand only exists in North America. It does not exist in Japan. In Japan, there are Toyotas. They sell the same models over there with a Toyota badge. The only reason they created Lexus was as a marketing division, because in this country, Americans are hung up on their badge. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they won't pay $40,000 or $50,000 for a mere Toyota, but if they put a Lexus badge on the same thing, they will.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Nissan did that. Honda did it. They all did that. They came up with a luxury brand. But of course, you know, we would do that for the longest time with Cadillac, for example. You know, Cadillac stopped being a special thing. And I remember going back to the Cimarrons and everything, which is a rebadged Jeep Chevy or something that they rebadged as a Cadillac.
So yeah, that's the Cavalier.
Yeah, that's right.
One of the most infamous and notorious crap cars that General Motors ever made.
Yeah, badge it as a Cadillac. And there you go, voila. We can mark it up several thousand dollars. So it's like the Japanese are looking, they're not stupid. It's like, hey, we could do that too. Let's talk about your article, The Auto Bond, and as in terms of band.
Yeah.
And the amazing reaction of this quote-unquote automotive journalist for CNN, his experience and his animus towards the idea of the Auto Bond.
Yep. Well, you know, they're attacking it, of course, on the basis of climate change. You know, it's if you drive faster than a crawl, your vehicle is emitting more carbon dioxide, and so we can't have that. So naturally, they have to go after the Autobahn, which is one of the few things left to do in Germany. There are high-speed sections, not the entire Autobahn, but there are sections where there aren't speed limits, and people are at their discretion to drive at speeds they think are appropriate. And interestingly enough, they do it very safely.
Yeah.
They have a lower fatality rate on those high-speed sections of the Autobahn than we have on the interstate system, because over there, people are given the freedom, the license to drive, but they know how to drive. Mm-hmm. You know, so they're not restrained by these dumbed-down speed limits that result in people being timid, passive-aggressive, and just terrible drivers who can't drive a car safely at 70, whereas in Germany, they can drive safely at 140.
That's right. And you stay in the right-hand lane unless you're passing somebody, right? And they're very adamant about that. I remember when I was in high school, I used to read my dad's Business Week subscription. And I remember they had a story, and it was about the German economy. But the metaphor that they used was there was this guy who was a World War II veteran. He had lost an arm in the war, but now he was a CEO of a company. And he had just driven with one arm, driven across you know, a large part of Germany on the Autobahn at about 150 miles an hour with one arm. And they just thought that was amazing. But they said, that's a great metaphor for what the German economy is. And it's like, well, I don't care about the German economy. I want to get on the Autobahn. Mm-hmm. It's like they've got this one little thing in this authoritarian society, so many rules about everything. And it's almost like it's a little pressure relief valve there for
it is. And it's a striking display of the axiom that people will rise or fall to the level that they're expected to rise or fall to.
Mm-hmm.
You give people the opportunity to be responsible and to display competence, and generally speaking, they will. Of course, some won't, but you know, there are ways to handle that rather than treating everybody as a presumptive moron. And when you treat everybody as a presumptive moron, you tend to get more morons in the end.
That's right. Yeah. Let me just read this little statement here that you got at the beginning of the article about this guy. What's his name? Paul Hakanos? Is that the way you pronounce it?
Hakanos, yep.
Yeah. He said, you quote him, he says, it's utterly disconcerting when ticking along at a brisk 75 miles per hour, somebody blows by me on the left and then disappears over the horizon as if I were driving a lawnmower. And you reply, poor old Clover. Tell people who are listening about Clover. It's all over your site. You've got bumper stickers for Clover stuff. Tell people about your Clover story.
Yeah, that's just some inside baseball. We had a troll on the site for a number of years who identified himself as Clover, and he was a person similar to this Hakanos character who equated any driving faster than any speed limit with recklessness and was very much a member in good standing of the safety cult. And, you know, this guy Hakanos, he doesn't understand the ethos in Germany, which is to use your mirrors. And as you said earlier, to, you know, stay out of the fast lane if you're not passing. And that's the mentality of German drivers, and that's why it's safe. People use their mirrors. You don't just dope along and expect people to accommodate you. You scan your mirrors, and if you see somebody coming up behind you fast, you see the headlights, you move over.
That's right.
Very straightforward. And if people would practice that kind of lane discipline, we could have unlimited speeds here on our interstate highway system too.
Yeah, but the attitude here is, we got a speed limit. I'm doing the speed limit, and I don't care if I'm in the fast lane. This is my lane. you immediately talk about 75 miles an hour. That was what our interstates were designed to, how they were designed to be used with cars that were made in the 1960s. And I remember that, you know, that's the thing that bothered me so much. I had just started driving before Nixon put in the 55 mile an hour speed limit. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, you know, they drop the speed by 20 miles per hour, even though the cars are much better than what they designed them for. You know, they designed the Interstate for cars that were made in the 50s to be able to drive 75 miles an hour, assuming that they could get it to that speed. But, you know, even at that point in time when Nixon put the hammer down on it, it was ludicrous. But now it's even more so, as you point out.
Oh, yeah. We've had, 60 years of advancements in vehicle design, such that practically, I think, every new car has four-wheel disc brakes, has pretty decent tires on it, has a suspension that's light years more advanced than what was common and typical back in the 60s, and yet the fastest legal speeds in this country outside of Texas are 75 miles an hour, just like they were back in 1967.
Yeah. And by the way, you know, that toll road where they've got an 85 mile an hour speed limit, and there's several roads that have, that are close to that. I think 80 or something like that, I think, was the speed limit. I kind of sometimes pay attention to the speed limit. But one thing I did notice when you talk about clovers, the speed limits are generally high in Texas. And it's the roads that are in poor state. Really is what limits you in most cases. They don't maintain the roads up to the standard that they should. But I'd noticed when we lived in Texas that people would typically drive 5 to 10 miles per hour below the speed limit. I would just see that all the time, you know, on the back roads and stuff. And they've got a toll road there that is the fastest speed limit in the U.S., 85 miles an hour. And yet that toll road went bankrupt. For two reasons. People don't like to pay tolls, and secondly, they just don't care about going that fast in the U.S. It's kind of strange.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's not so strange because we've had, 50 years now of methodical, deliberate passivity training in people, mm-hmm. You know, discouraging anything that would be non-cloverish, to use my term. if you drive with other than a Fabergé egg under the accelerator pedal, that's considered aggressive. Safety is synonymous with slow. And, you know, generations now of people have been reared that way.
Yeah.
They have been taught to drive, and I put that in air fingers quote marks, you know, using a car with an automatic transmission. Many of them never learned how to drive a manual car. And so they just sit there. And they tap their touch screen, and they play with their apps and stuff, and they're not in any particular hurry. The work has been almost complete. These people are perfectly ready to be put into their electric pods and transported from A to B.
That's right. Where they brag about the fact that they will go so slowly that you can set your coffee cup up on the dashboard and not have it spill or slide off. You know, that's their goal, you know, to have everybody in some kind of a remote-controlled golf cart. But this guy you point out, Paul Hachinos for CNN, you point out that he is somebody who used to work for the Council on Foreign Relations. So he's there. You know, they pick these people. They're not just diversity hires. They're people who are going to push the agenda that they want everybody to have, you know, anti-car, save the planet nonsense.
Yeah, they want everybody pedaling around in their 15-minute freedom cities.
Mm-hmm. Now, you point out he also is concerned about the fact that the people who drive fast, he thinks, are, quote, overwhelmingly male.
Right. Just like, you know, car journalists used to be overwhelmingly male, too. That's an indictment somehow.
Yeah, yeah. So for the sake of something feminine, as you put out, literally Mother Earth. That's absolutely true. We got a comment, and thank you for the tip, Harps in Australia. He writes, Lexus is sold here in Australia. So they've got it one other place there.
Yeah.
I drove a car. We went to New Zealand. I've never been to Australia, but we went to New Zealand once. And I got a chance to drive on the wrong side of the road.
Isn't that great?
But it was okay because we were upside down, so it all kind of worked out, you know.
Did you do it in a right-hand drive with a manual transmission?
Actually did. So it was an interesting experience. You just have to keep telling yourself, you know, when you're taking turns, you got to stay in the center of the road and things like that. So we're able to navigate it. And fortunately, you know, it wasn't really heavy traffic. There weren't any big cities in New Zealand and that type of thing. So there was a lot of margin for error that was there. Our biggest issue was just trying to make our way around because we didn't, you know, I had to use paper maps, which we've all forgotten how to use paper maps now because our brain has atrophied.
It's terrible. And by the way, a couple of days ago, I was drooling over a gray market, mid-late 90s Toyota Hilux Surf, which of course they never sold here.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Right-hand drive.
How'd you find that?
With a diesel engine.
Huh. Somebody got that into the U.S.?
Yeah, yeah. You know, they can do that because I think if they're older than 96, I think, they get grandfathered in, and you don't have to worry about the EPA goons showing up to hut.
Wow.
But nonetheless, you know, I look at this thing and I think to myself, it's basically a Toyota 4Runner, except it has a diesel engine and it gets 40 miles per gallon. And Americans were never allowed to have a vehicle like that.
I remember when Top Gear had a Hilux and they tried their best to kill it and they couldn't kill it. And they actually, they smashed it. They drove it into the sea. They did all kinds of things and the thing still kept running and they were just, they couldn't believe what was happening with it. And of course, you know, not available here in the U.S., but they took this smashed up, burned thing that was still running and they propped it up in their studio as part of their program years ago in a place of honor, you know.
That's why that the jihadis love it. You watch any footage from the Middle East and, you know, those Bedouins who have the AKs mounted in the bed, they're driving Hiluxes.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And again, going back to this article with this this CFR writer who's now writing for CNN, right? Cycling highways.
Yeah, isn't that great? Cycling highways. And, you know, one of the things about that, there are many facets to this, but one of them that always astounds me because of the way the left cognitively dissonance everything. Okay, so cycle lanes. Well, that's just wonderful if you're young enough and able-bodied enough to cycle. But there are a lot of people who are in no position to jump on a bicycle and cycle, you know, five miles down the road. Older people aren't going to be able to do that. You know, women with kids aren't going to be able to do that. So essentially, they're hobbling pretty much everybody who isn't a young person from being able to get from A to B.
That's right. Yeah, as you talk about, you know, trying to ban things on the Autobahn, and of course, they have already agreed that they are going to ban all internal combustion engines. It's been approved by the European Parliament. It's been approved by pretty much everybody in Europe, but now at the last minute, because Ferrari and Porsche are taking a stand against this, the EU ban on internal combustion engine cars has now been put on hold because the governments of Italy and Germany, where they revere Porsche and Ferrari, are pushing back on this, pressuring back on this. Italy's deputy prime minister said the delay in passing the ban is, quote, a great signal. The German transport minister said Europe, quote, needs e-fuels because there's no alternative to operate our existing fleet in a climate neutral manner. So here's what they're doing. And you and I have talked about this in the past. You know, Porsche came up with this idea that they can create, you know, carbon neutral fuels, the e-fuels, right? They do them in a special island down at the tip of South America where the wind blows constantly. So they don't, they're constantly using wind power. And they take captured carbon dioxide and they liquefy that. And then they take this bespoke fuel, which is probably as expensive as a fine wine. And then they put that in their expensive cars. And when it burns, it creates, you know, carbon dioxide and all the other gases that come out. But they say it's neutral because that's what we began with. And so they want a loophole for the uber rich and the rest of us can go pound sand, right?
Yeah, that's what's going to happen. I don't think that internal combustion-powered cars will go away. I think they'll be rarefied. You and I have discussed this before. At the dawn of the automotive era, you go back 100 and something years, cars were the toys of the very affluent. They were largely hand-built and custom-ordered, and that's where we're headed. You know, if you're somebody who can afford to spend six figures plus for a vehicle, they will allow you to have one. But us, the lowing cattle, will be denied use of anything that isn't some form of transportation appliance, probably that's under the control of not us.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, part of that story just shows how there's so many different engineering solutions that we could do for things and they won't allow it. It shows how this is all a political thing and how, you know, even if you come up with something like that, I know when we're looking around at cars, my son who just, you know, bought the car at the auction had been looking around at the Chevy Volt, I think it is. It's got the generator on board so that you don't have a range limitation. It was the only one that you liked. And he mentioned that. He said, that's the only electric car that Eric likes. And it seems like it's a pretty good thing. But, you know, trying to find one, they haven't made them for a couple of years, and they're still very expensive. And the batteries are super expensive. Even though it's got a smaller battery, the batteries are more expensive to replace than some of the other cars that are out there. So he wound up not going that way. You know, they won't accept anything. You know, even a small generator that occasionally kicks on has a little bit of emissions. They don't want hybrid cars, and they don't even want to have something like this as ridiculously expensive and complicated as the e-fuels are. They won't even allow something like this, which is neutral. You know, it's not creating anything that wasn't already there.
Do you remember once upon a time when government and the regulatory apparatus had to abide by cost-benefit analysis?
Yeah, that's right. Once upon a time, remember they had a budget and things.
Yeah, I'm all for bringing that back. You know, if they're going to promulgate a new regulation, let's look at the cost and the benefit. I made the point back when Volkswagen got excoriated over cheating on government emissions certification tests with regard to its diesels. You're talking about angels dancing on the head of a pin differences, literally fractions of a percent difference. And there's no cost benefit there. There's no benefit there for the cost. You know, who's being hurt? And the answer is nobody.
Yeah.
So, you know, unless you can demonstrate an objective and tangible harm, I think that a regulation that's proposed should be dismissed out of hand.
Well, we've gone way the other direction, haven't we, with all this lockdown and everything? Safety and efficacy for the vaccines, for the masks, for any of this stuff. They don't care about that anymore. You just do as I say. That's what it's really about.
Yes, but they have to lie about it, too. You know, they will, for example, they will talk about how the cheating Volkswagens emitted up to 40 times the allowable amount of emissions. And, you know, to the layman, to the average person who hasn't looked into it, that sounds, wow, that's a big deal. But then you dig into it a little bit, and what they're talking about is 40% of 0.0-something percent. It's an immaterial, negligible amount of difference, and you cannot adduce any harm caused by it. And that, I think, ultimately ought to be the way things go when we revert back to sanity. You know, you're going to propose a regulation. Okay, what's it going to cost, and what's the benefit going to be? And if the math doesn't work out, then that regulation should be put into the can.
That's right. Well, you and I have talked about this for a long time, the Volkswagen scam. Nobody died. They say, well, you cheated on your report to us. And so we're going to hit you a $4 billion fine. It's like, are you kidding me? You know, look at the exploding Pintos. We've talked about all that stuff.
Right.
You know, look at the Takata airbags that have killed, you know, 14, 15 people or something worldwide. They don't put that kind of fine against anybody. They came at criminal charges against the Volkswagen CEO just to intimidate them to take down a very efficient internal combustion engine that was going to make it harder for them to push EVs on us.
And contrast that with what we know about the effects of the so-called vaccines.
Yeah.
How many people have been killed by the vaccines?
That's right.
As opposed to how many people weren't killed by Volkswagen's diesels. Yet, you know, they're not pulling those dangerous drugs, objectively dangerous drugs, off of the market, are they?
No, absolutely not. As we got another comment here from Harps in Australia. He says, David's biggest issue driving in New Zealand was sheep, not other cars. That's right. There were a lot, there were more sheep than there were people, more sheep than there were cars. That's absolutely true.
Unfortunately, there's more sheep here in America than there are in New Zealand.
That's right. Yeah. The last couple of years, we've seen the people here turn into sheep. That's for sure. Yeah, it is interesting, as Travis said, you know, in put up on the screen, he said in New Zealand, it's like the animals there are all trying to kill you. I remember when we were there, there was a red possum that was an endangered species in Australia, but they had bounties on it in New Zealand. And so the people who were visiting from Australia at the time said, I can't believe it. You know, it's like seeing a bounty on an eagle, you know,
sure.
if you go to another country. Because, you know, this thing that was, you know, the bottom of the predator chain in Australia was at the top of the predator chain in New Zealand. I mean, they got very mild animals that are there. But about the worst thing, they got sand flies, you know. And
well, here's a good story for you. This also dates back to the 90s. I was on a Ford press trip, and we were out in Alaska, testing out the then-new Ford Explorer, the one of the rollover fame. Anyway, we were given route maps like we usually are that starts you out at A, and you know you end up at B a couple hundred miles down the road. And this was out in Alaska, out in the middle of nowhere. And I found myself meandering down this this road in Alaska, came around a corner, and there was a bull moose standing in the middle of the road.
Wow. Wow.
And I stopped, and I very gingerly backed up, because the thing would have just destroyed the Explorer and me along with it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He didn't charge you, huh?
He did not. He lowered his head, went back to munching, and I breathed a sigh of relief and went back on my way via another way.
Wow. Wow. That's great. Yeah. I remember coming up here in, you know, Smoky Mountain area when I was a kid. Bears all over the place. I'd have to get these things transferred. I've got 8mm film of us feeding the bears through the cracks in the windows and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you just don't see them anymore. I mean, they've got them so far removed into the park that I haven't seen one for many, many years. I haven't seen one the year that we've been here as well. You got an article about what the Corvette was and should be again, because, you know, we're just talking about the exotic, expensive cars and how, you know, hey, Porsches and Ferraris, you should be able to drive them with your fine wine fuel that you that you made with windmills. But the Corvette's a good example of what's happened, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, for a car that is a formidable performer, that is quicker, faster, better handling than any Corvette ever, it's a remarkably anodyne car to me. It looks just like any other insectoid exotic car. You park it next to a McLaren or a Ferrari, and you know, if you don't look closely and if you don't find the badge, it's really hard to tell the difference.
Mm-hmm.
The other day, my girlfriend and I went to an old car museum, and they had a 71 Stingray there. And you know, you'd see that car from a football field away, and everybody knows what it is. And you know, it may not get to 60 in 2.9 seconds or whatever the current Stingray does. And no, it's not going to do the fastest lap time around the Nürburgring. But the thing is just gorgeous, you know, and just looking at it is almost enough, and driving it is a treat. And the other thing about it that I got into in the article was that it was affordable, which the new one isn't. It was more expensive than a Camaro, but it wasn't that much more expensive back in the day. If you could afford a Camaro, if you saved up for a while, you could get a Corvette.
Mm-hmm.
Today, the Corvette starts at around $65,000, which puts it out of the league of almost everybody except the, you know, the affluent. Here we go again. You know, all the fun is reserved to people who have lots of money, and everybody else can just walk.
And as you point out, you know, the people who can afford it are typically going to be older, and they're not professional race car drivers. So they're only going to use a tiny fraction of this performance that they're paying through the nose to have. I mean, it is really wasted performance because you can't drive that anywhere on the streets. These people typically are not going to take their cars onto a track and race it either. What's it there for? Is it there for, bragging power? What? I don't get it.
Yeah, that's what it is. It's for driving around and saying, look at me. You know, it's automatic only now. You can't get a manual transmission in the car. And most of the performance is automated. You get in the thing, you push the button, it starts. You put the gear selector in drive, and then the launch control takes over. The stability control makes sure you don't wrap it around a tree. There's very little for you as a driver to do. It just sit there and push on the pedal. Whereas getting in something like that 71 Stingray I mentioned, that was an involving experience. Four-speed, clutch, you know, you had to control the car. It was up to you. And while it didn't have the level of capability that the new car has, its capabilities were closer to yours, to, you know, the average person. So you could actually really drive the car. And that was exhilarating and satisfying in a way that driving these new exotics just isn't.
That's right. I feel that way about my Miata. You know, they have resisted, and I think wisely, resisted putting bigger engines in them, and because they know that most people are not going to be able to use that power. I mean, you can go out and you can do aftermarket stuff. You know, you can you can turbocharge it. You can even drop a V8 in it, but that completely changes the character of the thing. It's not what it's about. That's like taking a Lotus and making it into a heavy electric battery vehicle. You know, that's completely antithetical to what it's all about. And so you take a car, which, you know, you're talking about the older Vets, or you talk about the Miata. It's all about, you know, the experience of being in the open air, the connection that you got through the manual shifter, and the fact that the horsepower is sufficient and it's matched to what's there, but it actually, you know, gives you another, instead of a really fast, a straight line acceleration, you know, you're looking at maintaining your speed, and you're able to do that because they focused on things that, you know, you talk about the automotive press. They were the ones who started pushing the 0 to 60 thing. That became the benchmark.
Yep.
And you know, that doesn't really tell you that much about the car, but everybody, that's the first thing. Well, so you're 0 to 60, and you get these, you know, tiny fractional improvements that have been driving. This is one of the reasons why, you know, they wanted to go to a rear engine car and a super automatic transmission, was so they could shave off a tenth of a second off of their 0 to 60 time.
Right. The other thing about these cars too, because of the fact that their capabilities are so high, in a way they're dangerous because they almost encourage you to push it and push it because they're so easy to drive fast.
Mm-hmm.
You know, almost comically easy. You can get in a car like the new Corvette, and let's say there's a place I like to drive called Bent Mountain, and it has a series of S-turns that are 35 miles an hour. You can easily take it at 70 in a car like a Corvette without even trying, with one finger on the wheel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in order to begin to get any kind of real feedback and sensation that you're doing something, you have to kick it up another notch. And by that time, you're at the point where you're way beyond your own limits as a driver, and even potentially at the limit of what the safety systems can do to get you out of trouble if the car gets out of hand. So I see this whole thing as both defeating, counterproductive, and dangerous.
Yeah, I agree. My son put up a comment. So they made most cars so boring and awful, you want to be disconnected and disassociated from it. And mm-hmm. that's the danger. You know, I find that, you know, even driving our other car, the family car, it's got an automatic in it. You know, it's a Mazda 5. And you know, I'm you know, I'm more dangerous as a driver with that car because I'm not as connected to what's going on. You know, the manual there connects you to the driving. I enjoy the driving more, but I'm also thinking about what's coming. You know, am I going to shift it into another gear? Do I have to slow down because there's somebody up ahead that's about to make a left turn or something like that? So you're constantly engaged like that, whereas with the automatic, it takes you out of it. And everything that they add to it actually kind of puts you to sleep. That's the odd thing about it. It's counterproductive, I think.
Yeah, well, you're isolated from the external world, too. If you've ever had the good fortune to drive something like a Lotus 7, which is kind of like your Miata, you are aware of the external world. You can hear the wind. You can hear the road. Mm-hmm. Heck, you can hear birds chirping. You know, you're out there. You're involved in a way that you can't duplicate except on perhaps a motorcycle. Mm-hmm. And that also is a sensory input, whereas when you're in this pod and it's so insulated from the external world, you're disconnected from the world and you're disconnected from the drive as you're trying to drive the thing.
That's right. Yeah, we have, and that's the thing, you know, most people are riding around, they got air conditioning and the windows up. We drive around, we drive around in 40 degree weather with a top down, the heater blaring, you know, and, you know, drive around in the rain sometimes as mm-hmm. long as there's not a lot of traffic and we don't have to stop, you know, if it's, you know, if we can keep it going 30 miles an hour and it's not raining real heavy, we don't get wet. I've got a comment
here.
Yeah,
the Miata is brilliant at that. You know, I've pointed out to people, if you, as long as you keep moving, you know, in a Miata with a top down, even in a thunderstorm, you're fine. Mm-hmm. You won't get soaked as long as you can keep moving.
What happened to us was we had to stop, and then I've got one with a power top on it, and that takes 12 seconds, and we got absolutely soaked. But now I've got one that I bought a little aftermarket thing that I put in, and it lets you override the controls that stop it if you're not, you know, if you're not stopped. And so I can raise the top while I'm still going 30 miles an hour. And so it's the best of both worlds. I don't have to stop. I don't have to get wet. I've got a comment here on Rumble from Sprumford. He says, I've got a 73 Vette, never getting rid of it. Absolutely. You know, we've all got older cars that we wish that we had not gotten rid of, don't we?
Yeah, when we were at the museum the other day, it just brought back memories of what it was like when I was a kid going to a new car showroom and how exciting it was to see how many different kinds of cars there were. Mm-hmm. You know, every possible combination, every possible feature, just differences, whereas now they're all so bleakly the same extruded plastic blobs. You know, they had things like, I'm just pulling this stuff out of my hat, but they had a Saab Sonnet there. They had a couple of Pacers. They even had a Chrysler Cordoba. It was wonderful.
With fine Corinthian leather, right?
With rich Corinthian leather, absolutely.
As the commercial went. Yeah, know all about those things. This is, I've got a person here who left a tip. Thank you so much, Christoa. Thank you. Left $2. Said, sorry, it's not $2.50. Well, thank you. You know what? Every little bit matters. And if we had most of the people who listen to the program, don't contribute. If they would give $2, that would do the budget right there. So I do appreciate that. Thank you. There's an article here about Mississippi passing a bill restricting electric car dealerships. And of course, this is aimed at Tesla, and they're doing this for the established automakers who now are directly competing against Tesla. And you know, they're saying, well, we're saying that if you choose to have a brick and mortar dealership, you have to follow the same laws that everybody else has to follow. Please don't tell me that Tesla's car doesn't identify as a car. I've seen the same type of thing, Eric, with Uber, right? And Lyft in Austin, they were saying, well, you know, we've had a couple of situations and there were national reports as well. They didn't have to follow the rules that taxis did, right? And so there's all kinds of regulations, as we all know, for taxis. And you'd be surprised at how many there are there. I did a report one time when I was in Washington, D.C., and I just let a taxi driver there talk about the white glove treatment that they got from the special people that were there just to harass taxi drivers. Mm-hmm. And of course, Uber and Lyft didn't have to do any of that stuff. And so in Austin, they were saying, well, we want Uber and Lyft to have to vet their drivers and things like that, like the taxi drivers do. And everybody said, oh, no, we don't want to do that. And it's like, well, how about we go the other way? How about we just take off some of these regulations off of some of the taxis? And, you know, you could go that way and you could say, well, let's take off some of the regulations on these brick and mortar stores, but they will always go to taking each other down to the lowest level. Instead of trying to remove any restrictions, they'll add more restrictions to other people, won't they?
Yeah, I'm a free market guy. I don't see why the state should have any involvement whatsoever in a free market exchange. However, that transaction happens to go as long as it's freely engaged in by the parties. You know, I'll defend Tesla here.
Yeah.
If somebody wants to buy one of their cars on the internet, why shouldn't they be able to do that?
Exactly.
You know, I don't see why Tesla or anybody else should be obliged to have a brick and mortar store in order to sell a vehicle.
That's right. Something that I talked about last week, you've got an excellent article on it, and that is the new move, the new patents by Ford about how, well, if we got to repossess a car, you know, we can shut down the air conditioning, or we can shut down this, or we can shut down the motor, or once we get to the point where we can have a self-driving car, we'll have it repossess itself. But you went in, and the article that you got on your site, you at the very top of the article, you got a picture from the patent application, which was something that I had not seen. Tell people what else they're doing. This is not simply about repossession of a car. Tell them what else is there.
Yeah, superficially, how could you argue with repossessing a car? You know, if you don't pay for what your loan, well, I don't have a problem with the person who you welched getting their property back.
That's right.
You know, that's a perfectly legitimate thing. But if you look in the patent application, it's all about the connectedness of the vehicle, and not just to the lender and not just to the manufacturer, but they also had a little diagram showing it was connected to the medical system and the police system, so that you could see where this is headed, that in the future, if you don't get your vaccine, let's say, or you don't wear your face diaper, that then they can simply shut off your car or even repossess it or take it away from you for noncompliance. And that is the sort of future that they have in mind for us.
That's the amazing thing. You know, when I talked about it, I kind of talked about it from the standpoint, well, that tells us something about what Ford sees the economy going, right? We're going to and that is ramping up now. They sold a lot of people automobile loans, as you and I have been talking about for years, how expensive the cars have gotten because of federal mandates and everything. People are having to take them out to 7-year loans and that type of thing, and they can't sustain this. So they see a big wave of repos coming. So they're talking about how can we get these things back. I talked about it from that standpoint as well. But when you look at this diagram, go ahead and pull that diagram back up again, Travis. The top two things that they've got on their patent thing are, you know, the two things that you would expect, a repossession agency and a lending institution, right? You would expect those. But the top two things that they've got are the police authority and the medical facility.
Yep.
Yeah. Ground your car because, what, you haven't had your vaccine? What's...
Right, exactly. And they talk about this Internet of Things, this connectedness of everything. Which is exactly what it sounds like. You know, there's no longer discrete, independent, under your control stuff. Your stuff is always tethered to, connected to, some kind of a centralized control apparatus that can, at its whim, simply revoke your conditional use, your privilege to be allowed to use what you thought was your property.
Sounds to me like a Trump Freedom City.
Yes, exactly.
That's what it's for. That's what the Freedom Cities, the 15-minute cities, the smart cities for slaves, that's what all this stuff is about.
Yeah, to get a picture of this, you know, I like to reference this to people who don't remember it. There was a great show, I'm sure you'll remember it, that the BBC did back in the 60s called The Prisoner with Patrick McGoohan. And he was a recalcitrant secret agent man who attempted to quit the secret agency. And they gassed him and knocked him out, and they took him to the village, you know, where he was kept isolated and couldn't get away. And it was kind of a prison without obvious barking German shepherds and guards. But he couldn't get away, and everything was completely under the control of whoever controlled the village.
That's right. Yeah, and they would do things to him if he was unmutual.
Yes.
So if you're unmutual, they'll do things to you, and that's where this medical thing really comes in. Yeah. Have you been following this? So I forget what state it's in. I've got it here somewhere. But the there's a lady who they diagnosed as having tuberculosis. And they said, well, we want you to go in quarantine. And she said, I don't want to go into quarantine. Maybe she didn't think she had tuberculosis, or maybe she just doesn't want to go into quarantine. And so now they put out a warrant for her arrest, and they're going to go arrest her. Well, that's what this would be for, right? To do that type of thing. We've got, you know, the WHO's got a new, you know, virus of the week. And they say this is going to kill everybody. And we have determined that you may have been exposed to somebody who may have been exposed to somebody who may have had it. So we're going to come arrest you. You know, that's the type of thing that they're going to use this for. And you know, when you talk about this, we've had tuberculosis for a long time. I'd like to see them come to Doc Holliday and tell him that they're going to take him away. He'd probably reply and say, I'm your Huckleberry. You do.
The electric cars particularly, because electric cars are uniquely amenable to this form of control. They are literally tethered to a plug and then to a utility, and the utility is not under your control, and they can closely meter and ration your ability to get power for the EV, and then, of course, they can simply turn the EV off. Very simple. It's much more difficult. They cannot disconnect a car like my old Trans Am, for example, or any pre-computer, pre-connected car. As long as I have gas for it and they haven't fired an EMP at me, the thing is going to start and run, and I'll be able to drive it.
That's right. Yeah, that's why they've loaded these things up with all of these gadgets and devices, is so they can turn them off and have it under their complete control. Speaking of having things under their complete control, you got an article about CBDC, and you refer to it as the digital Lexington. Tell us why you call it that, and you start your article with a reference to the Tsar. Talk about that.
Yeah, well, there are events in history. One of them is the so-called Windsor Massacre that occurred in 1905 outside of St. Petersburg, where people had peacefully assembled, unarmed people, to express their grievances to the Tsar. And what happened was the Tsar's Imperial Guards mowed them down with sabers and gunfire. And at that point, people realized that the Tsar was not a nice man, that he was a malicious man. He didn't care about them at all, and that became the catalyst that led, unfortunately, to the revolution that put the communists in power. In our own country, we have Lexington and Concord, where it became clear to the colonists that the British couldn't be reasoned with, that these people were going to, they were intent upon subjugating the colonies. They sent British troops out to take away the munitions that had been stored in Lexington and Concord. And that made the revolution inevitable. And I think the CBDC thing is of a piece.
Yep.
I think people who get it understand that this can't stand. And if it does stand, we're doomed. We have to stand our ground on this one and fight, no matter what it takes.
I agree. Yeah, you mentioned it at the very beginning. In history, there are events that are better described as turning points. And I think, I'm not going to go in the weeds on that. I have an opportunity, and I've told people that I'm not going to be here tomorrow and the next day. I have an opportunity to speak to the Tennessee Senate. Senator Frank Nicely is trying to get a state bank as well as a metals depository. And there are other southern states that are trying to do this as well. And they're doing this to try to create something of a parallel system to the Federal Reserve System, which is both shaky in terms of economics of it, the deficit, inflation, that getting out of control, losing reserve status. What is that going to do to our country? But then this CBDC is one of the key things. And it's something that is just now people are starting to become a little bit aware of. And I think it is a turning point. And I think, Eric, part of it, and I'm not going to get into this with them, but part of it, I'm absolutely convinced that they know what they're doing. They're trying to completely change the world, because we're at a point of fourth turning. I don't know if you're familiar with Strauss and Howe, fourth turning.
Mm-hmm.
Every 80 years, things are changing, and we are synced up on a global cycle. And so they have an opportunity to change all the institutions globally at the same time, and to leverage their technology, and to do it on the kind of cycle where it's a turning point, and everybody is fed up with the corrupt institutions that we've got. They're ready for a change, and they want to seize that and spin it and take over control in their way. I think we truly are at a turning point.
No question. We have had the Federal Reserve controlling the supply of money in this country now since 1913, so more than 100 years, and they've been able to manipulate that power to create boom and bust cycles. But they've never actually been able to control us literally and in real time. And that's what would be possible with this digitized money, which you would only be allowed to use if you were obedient, and which they could turn off at any time they liked or simply take. People have pointed out, if all of your money is in an app on your phone, what's to stop the government or corporations from simply saying, well, we've just decided to debit you for however much as your climate tax, let's say. What are you going to do about it?
That's right. And as you point out, this has been Biden's fixation from day one. Just like his fixation has been to remove our energy, his fixation has also been to completely reorganize our financial system and put it under the direct control of the Federal Reserve. Saleh Omarova, who is a dyed-in-the-wool Marxist, she graduated from Lenin University before the Soviet Union fell. He was going to put her in as comptroller of the currency, because this has been on their agenda from day one. And a year ago, last March, she put out a thing, for all of the bureaucracies under the executive branch to come up with a plan for how they're going to implement CBDC. But, it's interesting. We just had Trump at CPAC, and we had Nikki Haley and Pompeo and all these other people who want to run for president. Crickets about CBDC from them. Absolutely
very,
nothing.
Very telling.
Instead, he tells us about his Freedom City. comical.
This issue, the CBDC thing, should dwarf all others because they are subsidiary to it, and none of them will matter at all if this ends up coming to fruition.
Yeah, yeah. So I got a question here from listeners, Brian Deb McCarthy. Do you have a link to where we can watch you speaking? I don't, but I think that I'm going to be able to get a copy of it. If I do, I'll definitely play it for you. I would just say, everybody, you know, please be in prayer for this because, you know, there's going to be people who are not going to be amenable to hearing about any of it. They maybe already know about it and are already in favor of it. But there, I think there are some people who may not know about it. And so we just, you know, pray that God will move in a way that, whether it's me or somebody else, that they will hear what is about to come upon us. And I cannot understand why anybody would want this. As a matter of fact, we got a Federal Reserve governor who says, I can understand why China would want this. Why would we want this? You know, there's no need to fill that this fills except for an authoritarian government. That is exactly the only thing that this is for.
Yeah, and I hope a sufficiency of people understand that. Because if they do, this will die in the crib and
That's
hopefully
right.
be strangled with both hands very quickly.
Yeah, Rosemary's Baby is right in the crib right now. Yeah. We better not grow it into adulthood. Thank you so much for joining us, Eric Peters. Again, you can find Eric's excellent stuff on freedom and the freedom to move at epautos.com. Thank you, Eric. Always a pleasure talking to you.
Likewise, David. Thank you.
Thank you. And please do keep us in your prayers that this will be productive.
David Knight Show is a critical thinking super spreader. If you've been exposed to logic by listening to the David Knight Show, please do your part and try not to spread it. Financial support or simply telling others about the show causes this dangerous information to spread farther. People have to trust me. I mean, trust the science. Wear your mask. Take your vaccine. Don't ask questions.
Using free speech to free minds. It's the David Knight Show.